We are in lesson number 39. In the book of 1 Samuel, we're in chapter number 17. Last week, we had gotten down to verse number 52, and I want to read that verse again to you because Israel had heard the words of David when David had said back to David had turned Goliath's words back around on him. For Goliath has said, David, I'm going to feed your skin and your flesh to the birds and to the beasts today. And David had turned back that around and said, Goliath, I'm going to kill you. And I'm going to feed the men, the Philistines behind you, your warriors behind you. I'm going to feed their flesh to the birds and to the beasts today. And Israel had heard the words of David too when he made that promise. So the chasing of the Philistines ensued when David had killed Goliath and held up his head, killed him with his own sword, well, actually killed him with the stone that struck his head, but then chopped off his head with that sword of Goliath and held up his head, and the Philistines began to run. And just as David had foretold, here's the summary of what the Israelites did. Verse number 52. Then the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as the valley and to the gates of Ekron. And the slain Philistines lay along the way of Shaaraim, even to Gath and Ekron. The sons of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundered their camps. Well, there's some unpacking to do here. It is my opinion that verse 52 has a copy error in it, okay? I believe that somewhere down the road, the Hebrew got copied wrong. The Hebrew word for the word valley is G-A-I, or gay, G-A-Y, if we want to spell it with our I and Y sounds. The Hebrew word for Gath is Gat, G-A-T. You notice there's one letter difference at the end. Now, I believe that somewhere in the making of the copies of the copies from the original text, that the copies of the copies, the word for Gath was accidentally changed from valley, because they're all in a valley. The sentence probably should read, and I believe it should read, the men of Israel and Judah arose and shouted and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and to the gates of Ekron. In other words, they pursued them this way to Gath and then up to Ekron. All right, this makes perfect sense because the writer goes on to say that the Philistines were slain even to Gath and Ekron. Bound it up. So I believe there's a copy error there. Now, in addition, as we have already mentioned in a past verse in this chapter, the two armies were already in the valley of Elah. How did they chase them in the valley? They were already at that brook right there by Sokoh. How did they chase them as far as the valley? Okay. What valley would the Philistines have run to because they were already in a valley? So this point is another reason why the copy error is plausible. That's probably what happened. Gath and Ekron are two of the five major cities. Gath, Ekron, Ashdod, Ashkelon, and Gaza. Two of the five major cities of the Philistines. Of the five cities, three were near the coast. Ashdod, Ashkelon, Gaza, near the coast. Ekron and Gath were on the eastern border of the Philistine land. Right on the edge, right there at the Valley of Elah. I mean, basically, they're right at the edge of this valley going down into Elah, okay? So the town of Shaaraim sat at the in the Valley of Elah. We know where it is, okay? But it was in the tribal area of Judah. So it's in the tribal area of Judah. So we know where they are. We know where they are. And at the brook where David killed Goliath, Shaaraim sat behind the Philistines because of the way they were. I mean, the Philistines right here, Shaaraim is right there. Okay, that's all good. So, and on to Gath and on to Ekron, to the major city wall, they were walled cities. And so if the men could get there, they could get behind the walls and be safe from the Israelites. Now, these five cities of the Philistines were the only walled cities in the entire, what we're going to call the Gaza Strip. These Philistines that lived in the little villages when they were attacked, they would run to the to those five cities, and they would run into the gates, and the gates would be shut to protect them from the Israelites. And each city supported many little unwalled villages that surrounded each city. The Philistine warriors did not run to their homes in their villages because the villages could not protect them. Ekron and Gath could protect them. When the writer tells us that Israel pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and to the gates of Ekron, he is probably telling us that those Philistines who ran to Gath were all killed before they reached the city. He is also telling us that some of the Philistines who ran to Ekron probably made it into and behind the gates, which stopped the pursuit of Israel. In other words, some got away free. Now notice the interesting last line in this portion of the passage. The sons of Israel returned from chasing the Philistines and plundered their camps. It means that once Goliath was dead, the army of Israel crossed the brook to fight. The Philistines left all of their belongings in the camp and ran for their lives. Everything they owned, their tents, their beddings, their food, their gods, their gold this, their silver that, was left behind at the camp by the brook, and all they had with them was their weapons that they carried to fight with. The writer then inserts a summary of what David did. Verse number 54. Then David took the Philistine's head and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put the weapons in his tent. From the brook in the valley of Elah, where David killed Goliath, it was about 13 miles back to Jerusalem. Now Jerusalem, let's go ahead and put it in here. Here is about Jerusalem. Okay, it's about 13 miles going up to Jerusalem because of the way they had to go by the road and straight up. That's the reason why it'd be that, 13 miles. Okay, as we've said, the verse in a summary of what David did with the head and with the weapons. That's what it is, a summary. Based on the context that will come next, David did not leave the Israelite camp to take the Goliath's head to Jerusalem and put his weapons in his tent, meaning his home there in Bethlehem. Did not happen. The writer in this summary is just telling us the ultimate thing that happened to the head and the weapons, which we're going to find out is really not the ultimate thing later on with the weapons, but it probably was to begin with. But not at this time. By the way, the Hebrew word used for tent here is ohel, and it means dwelling. It does not mean to mean in a tent at the battle line. David took it to his ohel, his home in Bethlehem. In addition, Jerusalem was not a major city in Israel yet. The northern portion of what we know as Jerusalem was still in the hands of the Jebusites. I've told that to you many times. It's not going to be taken over by David until 7 years into David's reign as king. So the Jebusite citadel is here, and Jerusalem's on the other side of the line right there. So Jerusalem, what's happening here is the northern portion of what we know of Jerusalem is still in the hands of the Jebusites in the Benjamin's land. It will be 20 years before David will defeat the Jebusites and take the citadel for himself while he is king. South of the Jebusite city in Judah's land, Jerusalem was in the hands of Israel. But it was no more than a village at the time. No walls or anything. We do not know why David would take the head of Goliath there at this time in the storyline. However, if the skull of the Goliath was somehow preserved, we can't understand how David took the skull as a trophy to Jerusalem when he captured the citadel and made it his capital city, capital of his city and the nation of Israel some 27 years later. Okay, some 20 years later, I should say. Now, as far as the weapons of Goliath, David took them as a prize. In chapter 21, we will find that Goliath's sword was wrapped in a cloth and was in a sanctuary in Nob. Now, that's not where the tabernacle complex is. This is a sanctuary in Nob. Tabernacle complex may have been moved there, but we are not told that. However, in Acts chapter 15, verse 16, the tent at Nob will be called the Tabernacle of David. It's not the Tabernacle of the Lord. So we don't think it's the tabernacle complex, or at least I don't think so. So we will soon speak about that when we arrive there at that text in chapter 21 of this book. We're in chapter 17, coming up on verse 45 now. So, after inserting the summary, the writer then returns to give a summary of what Saul asked right after he saw David kill Goliath. Who was the conqueror? Saul asked his uncle, the commander of the army, Abner, verse 55a, chapter 17. Now when Saul saw David going out against the Philistines, he said to Abner, the commander of this army, Abner, whose son is this young man? All Saul knew about David was that he trusted him enough to be his armor bearer, and he was also his personal musician. Evidently, Saul did not know much about David's family. So with this question, he's saying, who is this son? Who is his father? What has his father taught him? He needed to know about them. He was about to place them on a royal status in the nation and free them from all governmental burdens. But he also wanted to know, who was the dad who caused his son to be this way? Abner could not answer Saul's question. Saul directed Abner to find the name of the conqueror and find out who his father was and what everything was about. Verse 55b, and Abner said, by your life, O king, I do not know. And the king said, you inquire whose son the youth is. David was carrying the head of the giant and his weapon as he headed back to the tent of Saul. And Abner saw David coming, and Abner delivered to Saul the conqueror. Verse 57. So when David returned from killing the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the Philistine's head in his hand, a bleeding head in one hand, and at least the sword in his other. We are not told about the javelin, we're not told about the spear, and we're not told about the shield of Goliath. But in his presence of Saul, with the head of Goliath, Saul asked, whose son are you? Verse 58. Saul said to him, whose son are you, young man? And David answered, I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite. In verse 56, and here in verse 58, Saul wants to know the name of David's father. Saul must put a decree in the records that Jesse's family will never be subject to governmental burdens of Israel. Now, be that as it may, the story of what happened between David and Saul on the day David killed Goliath was not over. There was Saul. David acquired a new fast friend. David had another psalm in him at this time. Before we talk about the fast friend, let's hear the psalm, the song that David put together to talk about this time. The psalm is addressed to the choir director on Muthalaban, a psalm of David. And David sings this song and he says, I will give thanks to the Lord with all my heart. I will tell of all your wonders. I will be glad and exult in you. I will sing praise to your name, O Most High. When my enemies turned back, they stumbled and perished before you. For you have maintained my just cause. You have sat on the throne judging righteously. You have rebuked the nations. You have destroyed the wicked. You have blotted out their name forever and ever. The enemy has come to an end in perpetual ruins, and you have uprooted the cities. The very memory of them has perished, but the Lord abides forever. He has established his throne for judgment, and he will judge the world in righteousness. He will execute judgment for the people with iniquity. The Lord also will be a stronghold for the oppressed, a stronghold in the times of troubles. And those who know your name will put their trust in you, for you, O Lord, have not forsaken those who seek you. Sing praises to the Lord who dwells in Zion. Declare among the peoples his deeds. For he who requires blood remembers them. He does not forget the cry of the afflicted. Be gracious to me, O Lord. See my affliction from those who hate me. You who lift me up from the gates of death, that I may tell of all your praises, that in the gates of the daughter of Zion I may rejoice in your salvation. The nations have sunk down in the pit which they have made, in the net which they have hid, their own feet have been caught. The Lord has made himself known. He has executed judgment. In the work of his own hands, the wicked is snared. Higayon, Selah. The word Selah means, what do you think of that? The wicked will return to Sheol, even all the nations who forget God. For the needy will not always be forgotten, nor the hope of the afflicted perish forever. Arise, O Lord, do not let man prevail. Let the nations be judged before you. Put them in fear. O Lord, let the nations know that they are but men. Selah. And as you've heard me say, I like to say to people, the word Selah means there. What do you think of that? It's a musical term. It says stop. Stop and think about what I am telling you. Nevertheless, in the development of this story, David finds a new friend, as I told you. The writer gives a summary of what Jonathan did. Chapter 18, verse number 1. They're in front of Saul. Now it came about when he had finished speaking to Saul that the soul of Jonathan was knit to the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as himself. Saul took him that day and did not let him return to his father's house. And then Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan stripped himself of the robe that was on him and gave it to David with his armor, including his sword and his bow and his belt. I want you to know the report here is remarkable, and it shows the true character of Jonathan. We must not forget that the battle successes of King Saul against the Philistines at Geba, where we first met Jonathan, were Jonathan's successes. The defeat of the Philistines at the pass of Michmash, where Jonathan and his armor bearer were there together alone without the help of any of the warriors of Israel, was all Jonathan's doing. And the Philistines began to melt away in all directions. As far as we know, Jonathan was the conqueror of Israel. King Saul had done little, and the successes we know of that were all attributed to his son, Jonathan. Even the last battle that we heard about there at Gilgal, Saul messed it up and didn't even complete the job. But the success on this day was David's, not Jonathan's. Think of the character of Jonathan. We have to wonder why Jonathan did not volunteer to face Goliath. Surely that thought crossed the mind of all the royals. If Jonathan had volunteered, surely the Lord would have helped him as he helped him at Michmash. Surely the Lord would have helped him as he helped him at Geba. The threat of one giant surely was not as fearful as the threat of a whole camp of thousands of Philistines against Jonathan and his armor bearer when they went in there by themselves. Be that as it may, if Jonathan had been a consideration, he was passed over. Then, in desperation, Saul announced the reward of the hand of his daughter in marriage to the man who conquered the giant. Well, that gift alone meant Jonathan could not step up to volunteer. It was strictly against the law of the Lord for Jonathan to marry his sister at least since the days of the Exodus. You could not marry your sister. Jonathan could not be the conqueror because of the scenario Saul had put everything in. David entered the picture, a young man not old enough to serve even in the battle. But David was old enough to take a wife, by the way. We have to wonder if David was even interested in marrying Saul's daughter. We have to wonder if David was even interested in his family being eternally free from the bondage of Israel's governmental requirements of taxes and forced labor for national projects. What will be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? The answer to him was, and it will be that the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. If David won, he would become a rich royal in the nation, married into the family of the king and freed from the debt, from debts of taxes and forced labor. The deed was done. Goliath was dead. The reward had not been immediately transferred to David at that moment, but they were on the way. David was the new conqueror of Israel. Jonathan had been set aside from his position, from that position. Yet Jonathan's true character shone through. He was not immoral. He was not impure, hostile, jealous, angry, argumentative, or in disagreement with David. Those qualities you should remember, because we have already discussed how these are all the qualities of Saul's character. Those qualities are listed by the Apostle Paul as the deeds of the flesh. No, Jonathan had other qualities. He looked at David with love and joy and peace and patience and kindness and goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control. Jonathan exhibited the fruit of the Spirit in his life. Jonathan's soul was knit together with David that day. We saw that same phrase used with Jacob's love for his son Benjamin in Genesis chapter 44, verse 30. It means Jonathan and David were bound together in life, from two souls to one soul together, knit together. It was the love relationship between two men that, as we will see, will affect David greatly for the rest of his life. David now was about 17 years old, give or take a year or so. We met Jonathan 20 years before in the story at Geba as a soldier in the Israelite army. Jonathan must be now about 37 years old, give or take a few years, one way or the other. He was probably even older than that. Think of it this way. David could have been Jonathan's son. In life, those of us who come along with young people often look to them like a son. I am currently 66 years old. Yet, a man by the name of Bobby Haynes, who just turned 80 years of age, looks to me as a son. For almost 30 years, he has worked for me, under me, in my ministry at my last church staff position, and he still looks at me like I'm his son and he's working for me. Travis Bryce, who has now joined the Lord in heaven, told me many times, many, many times, that he thought of me as a son. He was 78 years old when he went on to be with the Lord. And although we only met together maybe a couple of times over, maybe a dozen times, I should say, a couple of times over a dozen years, we were pen pals for more than 20 years, writing to each other almost every day of the work week and often late into the evenings. There was also Travis Terrell, who joined the Lord in heaven this year due to COVID-19. He was much younger than I, but I looked up to him like a father. Our souls were knit together in brotherly love from the moment we met in October of 1990 at a Wednesday night choir rehearsal. I cannot stop here. There were the Pittman brothers, Albert and Ryan. They looked to me as a son. 20 years ago was when I was in the hospital due to a fall down at the Danbury Project that I was leading and building for my last church at that location down there in Danbury. They were with me every day for a little more than 2 years. I picked them up every morning for a 45-minute drive down to Danbury to the site. At the hospital, whenever I was injured, They told my wife that they would charge hell with a water pistol for me. They separately told me I was like a son to them, even though they both have great sons. At the hospital, that's what they told them. They separately told them this to me. Then before I picked up the Pittman's brothers at 5 in the morning, I picked up Ed Tony. Sarah was his wife. Sarah Lynn Tony was his wife. She always had a cup of coffee for me and an egg sandwich for me. They both are like parents to me, and I am like a son to them, even though they have 3 wonderful sons. And what about Sam Davis? Sam joined the Lord in heaven too this year. From the time he retired as a sheet metal worker, he was almost always with me at my side every day, treating me like a son, for he thought of me like a son. And then there's John Capriva, a decade older than I am, who has told me many people that I was family since we met in 1999. We were knit instantly together. Quincy James, who's now with the Lord and who was a retired lawyer, attorney, hovered over me like a helicopter father, to make sure that I was taken care of when I met him in 1993. He was caring for me. Jack Kitchens, although I only knew him for about 3 years before he died, he strapped me in like a son, as those who knew him can picture, and would not let me go. Oh, the list goes on and on. Earl Havens and Bertie Havens King, 1994, my first church, strapped me in, fed me, watered me. Benton Kane, whenever I was 12 years old, latched onto me and wouldn't let me go until I left for college. Oh, the ministry. I want to tell you that story. I'm going to finish telling you about the people, men in my life, who have treated me like a son the next time we come back together.